Happy Mother's Day to everyone. If Mom is in the room with you right now, turn to Mom right now and say, Mom, you are amazing. Now say, Mom, thank you. I love you heaps. You know, Mother's Day is a great day to celebrate our moms, but it's also a difficult day for some people. Some people have lost their moms. They've gone on from this life. My mom's one of those. Some have heavy hearts because some moms have lost children. Children have passed on before they did. Some moms have their children estranged from them. Some people are estranged from their moms and they struggle. And some people would love to be a mom, but for some reason, they haven't been able to achieve that yet. That hasn't happened for them. If this is a difficult day for you, I want you to know that we love you and we're praying for you. But more importantly, I want you to know that God knows your pain. God cares. He loves you and he's there for you. If you are joining us today for the first time, I'd like to just really extend a special welcome to you. Thanks for joining in. We've been working through a letter that a guy called Paul wrote to a church he started in a place called Corinth. And as we've been going through that letter, we've learned a lot about it. But today we're starting a brand new series. So if this is your first time with us, you came at a great time. We're starting a series today called I'm Glad You Asked. See the signs, the posters? I'm glad you asked. We're answering some tricky questions. And the purpose behind that, or the idea behind that, is the Corinthians had written Paul a letter and they had asked him a lot of questions. So now he starts answering those questions beginning in chapter 7. Today we're going to kick off this series talking about marriage and singleness. And just as with last week, I gave you a little bit of a warning. We're going to be talking about sexual things a little bit, but I recognize we have families in the room, children watching, so we'll certainly handle those conversations gently. But I would also encourage you as parents to have those conversations with your kids when it's appropriate, when it comes up, and let them get information from you, not from everybody else. I'd like to also let you know from the outset today, we're going to be talking about some heavy stuff. We're going to be talking about marriage and divorce. We're going to be talking about celibacy for singles. And for some of you, those things are already a part of your past. And I would ask you to listen to this message and not hear it in a condemning way concerning your past. You can't change the past. And you may have been okay with what you did in the past. But today, I want you to apply the message to where you sit now, your current situation. So let's get started. 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the Apostle Paul writing says this, "Now regarding the questions you asked in your letter, yes, it is good to abstain from sexual relations. But because there is so much sexual immorality, each man should have his own wife, and each woman should have her own husband." The question that they have posed to Paul is it good to abstain from sexual relations? Essentially, the Corinthians here are asking Paul about marriage. There was two different mindsets. The context was that Paul is writing to a place where the city was filled with debauchery. There was all kinds of sexual immorality, and it had crept into the church. And there were two different views within the church about this. We talked about last week, one view that a lot of people had was that sex has nothing to do with my spirit and with my relationship with God, so everything's okay. The other view was more of a legalistic view that said sex is bad, sex is evil, no matter what, even in marriage, so we should just run from it completely. Paul answers the question, is it good to abstain from sexual relations, with an affirmation. He says, yes, abstinence is good. That word good that he uses there does not mean it is morally better. He is simply saying it is something that is commendable. It is commendable to live in abstinence, never marrying, never having sexual relationships. I think it's really, really important for us to note here that Paul is speaking of marriage because he says it's good to abstain, but each man should have his wife and each wife should have her husband because of sexual immorality. He is defining marriage the same way that God originally defined marriage, as one man and one woman. And that was countercultural, because polygamy would have been a thing there. The men would have had several wives and sex slaves, things like that. But he's also making it clear that it's one man, one woman. He didn't say each wife should have her wife and each husband should have his husband. It's a husband and a wife. So Paul makes that clear as he starts this out. And he's saying celibacy is good, but there are huge temptations. And to combat those temptations, marriage helps us to avoid sexual immorality. Now, before you go too far with that, Paul's not saying that is the only reason for marriage, is to avoid sexual immorality. Plenty of verses all through Scripture that talk about the beauty of marriage and other reasons for marriage. But Paul is simply responding to the specific question they are asking about the marriage relationship and whether sex is a part of that or not. And Paul's saying it's a vital part of it. In fact, he goes further in verse 3. He says, the husband should fulfill his wife's sexual needs, and the wife should fulfill her husband's needs. The wife gives authority over her body to her husband, and the husband gives authority over his body to his wife. He says, husbands and wives, you each have a responsibility here in the relationship. And the language he uses is so beautiful. Notice that he's talking about giving, not getting. The wife gives her body to the husband. The husband gives his body to the wife. It's not about getting. It's not about what can I get in this relationship. And again, this would have been a revolutionary thing, because Paul is telling both parties, men and women, that they need to give to the other. And for men, that would not have been culturally appropriate. They would have thought that they have every right over every woman to do whatever they want, basically, in society. So this was revolutionary. He's setting men and women at an equal plane here. For those of you that might think Paul was a bit misogynistic in his writings and his teachings, obviously, the people that think that have missed what he's saying here, because he's setting them both up equally. He goes on in verse 5, he says, do not deprive each other of sexual relations unless you both agree to refrain from sexual intimacy for a limited time, so you can give yourselves more completely to prayer. Afterward, you should come together again so that Satan won't be able to tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Very simply put, he said the only reason to abstain in marriage is for an agreed season of prayer. That is the only reason to abstain. And even with that, he says, and when you're done with the praying, come back quickly together to avoid sexual immorality. This is a massive, massive issue in marital breakdown. Over the many years I've been in ministry, it's one of the top three things that people present with when they're having marital conflict. Money, communication, and sexual intimacy are the main things. I was shocked early on in ministry, the first time I dealt with this, where I'm talking to people who have been married for more than a decade and could count on one hand the number of times they have been intimate with one another. Not a healthy relationship. See, Paul is saying here that it should be given freely by each party. It should not be used as a bargaining chip. It should not be reused as a reward. It should not be withheld as a punishment. But just like it should not be withheld, we need to be very careful here and not assume that it can be demanded by either spouse. Now, Paul doesn't define how often this should happen in a marriage, but the language is pretty clear. Enough so that it helps protect against sexual immorality. I would also make it clear that if this is not a healthy part of your marriage, that does not give you permission. That does not give you the right to go and seek fulfillment outside of your marriage. That's not what Paul's saying. He's saying, yes, you need to be healthy about it, and both of you agree and all of that, but you need to have mutual respect and understanding, but it's only in the marriage relationship. Now, for the single people in the house, you out there, wave at me. Hey, single people, love you guys. Paul talks about you guys too, or to you guys. He says, but I wish everyone were single just as I am. Yet each person has a special gift from God of one kind or another. So the question I'm glad you asked is, I'm not married. Should I stay single? Paul says, I wish everyone were single, just like I am. Now, there's lots of opinions and speculation about whether Paul had ever been married or not, and a lot of good arguments on both sides of that, but we're not going to expand on that right now. Maybe in the after chat, if you want to know, ask a question about it. But Paul found it best to be single. In his life, the things that he was involved in, traveling, teaching, serving prison sentences, he didn't have to worry about a wife and a family when he was doing all of that. But he says singleness is a gift from God, and that is not for everyone. In verse 8, he says, so I say to those who aren't married and to widows, it's better to stay unmarried just as I am. But if they can't control themselves, they should go ahead and marry. It's better to marry than to burn with lust. So he's saying, well, celibacy and singleness is good, and that's his bias, that's his preference. He's saying marriage is more common, and marriage is fine, and it's better than burning with lust. For those that have the capacity, those that have the gift to remain single, there are great advantages, and we should celebrate those advantages. Those of you who are single, you have great freedom in being single, freedom for serving God that married people don't necessarily have. But he makes it clear it's not for everyone. So maybe you're sitting there, maybe you're single today, and you're saying, okay, hey, I know I don't have the gift of singleness, I can tell, and that's not going to work out for me. In fact, I know I'm going to get married. So here's the next question. Hey, we are engaged. Can we have sex before we get married? We know we're going to get married. We're committed to each other. Can we have sex before we actually get married? Well, Paul says this in verse 36. If a man thinks he's treating his fiancée improperly and will inevitably give in to his passion, let him marry her as he wishes. It is not a sin. Paul says, if you can't control your passions, get married. When I counsel young people or older people who are engaged or dating and considering marriage, they know they're going to get married, I counsel against long engagements. And that's gotten me in trouble. I've had parents say, what did you tell my kids? Because of this, if their passions are going to lead them to sexual activity before marriage, they should just go ahead and get married. The norm in our culture is for couples to live together before they get married, to live as man and wife. In fact, statistics tell us that 4 out of 5 couples live together, they cohabitate before they get married. The question that you need to answer if you're in that kind of a relationship, living as married people, why aren't you getting married? And some of you say, oh, I'm waiting, we're saving up for the wedding and all that. And Paul would say, just get married. I'm going to take a big risk and go another step further here and just say, you know, if you're living together as married people, who is not willing to commit here? Is it both of you? Is it one or the other of you? And if there's an unwillingness on one person's part to commit to the long-term married relationship, you should be asking yourself, is this person the person I want to spend the rest of my life with if they aren't willing to commit to marriage? If you're dating, if you're engaged, and you're going to get married, and then have the beautiful relationships that are designed for marriage. Okay, back to the married people. In verse 10, he says, but for those who are married, I have a command that comes not from me, but from the Lord. A wife must not leave her husband, but if she does leave him, let her remain single or else be reconciled to him. And the husband must not leave his wife. So here's the big question. You probably saw it on social media this week. Should I stay in a bad marriage or get a divorce? Culturally, we live in a disposable society. Everything is disposable, including marriage. Statistically, 1 in 3 marriages will end in divorce, and 1 out of 5 people will marry more than one time. Can I say marriage is hard? Marriage takes a lot of work, and even great marriages have difficult days and difficult seasons. So if you consider yourself in a bad marriage, should you get a divorce? Let's examine that biblically. See, in Christian circles, it is commonly accepted that adultery is grounds for divorce, that you are allowed to get a divorce if your spouse commits adultery. And that's based on some teaching Jesus did in Matthew chapter 19. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. There was an early church father called Origen, and he said this. He said, "It might be the subject of an investigation if Jesus hinders anyone from divorcing for poisoning," and then he gave a whole lot, a long list of other things. And basically he was saying, "But what if my wife tries to poison me? Do I have to stay married to her?" What do we say to people who are living in abusive relationships? That is a huge challenge. It's one that over the many years of ministry, I have wrestled with and had to help couples work through when they were in that situation. But I think for us to understand what God says about that, we need to actually go back to the Old Testament. If we go back to the Old Testament, we understand laws were written in a way that if it was written to one stream of society, generally speaking, it applied across all of society. An example of that would be in Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 4. It says, "Do not muzzle the ox who treads out the grain." That means if the ox is working, you need to feed the ox. Let the ox eat because he's working hard. Well, that same principle applies across the board. If your slave is working, make sure they have food. Make sure you're taking good care of them. If your employees are working, make sure you're paying them. And on and on and on. And it's repeated later in Corinthians, this whole principle, talking about church leaders being paid and things like that. So the law said that you don't muzzle the ox. And then that applied through society. If we take that same principle, and then we look back at Exodus chapter 21, in verse 10, it says this: "If a man who has married a slave wife takes another wife for himself, he must not neglect the rights of the first wife to food, clothing, and sexual intimacy. If he fails in any of these 3 obligations, she may leave as a free woman without making any payment." So if we take that same principle that applies across all society, this woman was free. This woman was free because of the abuse and neglect that she endured from her husband. So we see divorce was permitted in cases of abuse and neglect. In Jewish culture, marriage vows were very serious, and that's really where we take our marriage vows from today, the same way that the Jewish people did it back in the Old Testament days. And when a covenant was written, it was a binding covenant, but it had stipulations. And in the Jewish marriage ceremony, the covenant they were making would be read aloud to everyone to hear. And it would talk about all the requirements that were going to be involved in that marriage. And it would talk about what happens if that covenant is broken. And it would explain clearly who gets what when the marriage dissolves. Sounds kind of like a prenuptial agreement. And I'm not advocating for prenuptial agreements today. Do not go away and say, "Hey, Pastor Stan said we need a prenup and all that." That's not at all what I'm suggesting. Some of you may be sitting there thinking, "Okay, hang on a minute. There's Old Testament reasons and cultural reasons in the Jewish culture that we can see that divorce was permitted for things other than adultery. But what about what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 19? I'm glad you asked. You see, in chapter 19 of the book of Matthew, the Pharisees were asking Jesus about divorce. They said, "Is divorce okay for any reason?" And Jesus says, "No, the law is very clear about that." We need to understand the key to understanding this is looking at their question and understanding the culture of the day. Matthew 19, verse 3 says, some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason? That last phrase, any and every reason or any and every cause, is the key. Society had adopted a no-fault divorce. They called it an any-cause divorce. You didn't have to have any real reason for divorce, and you could get a divorce. That's the kind of divorce they're asking Jesus about. Can a man divorce his wife for any cause? An any-cause divorce. And that is what Jesus said no to. He says, no way. Go back and look at the law, which we've already looked at a little bit. And then they turned around in verse 7 and asked him about Moses. They said, Moses said that we could give our wives a writing of divorcement. Is that not okay? What they're referring to there in verse 7 was Deuteronomy chapter 24, where Moses talked about specifically divorce in the case of adultery. So when Jesus responds that, yeah, you can do that, but it was given because of the hardness of your hearts, he's talking specifically about the divorce based on adultery. He's not talking about all Old Testament divorces. So if we take all of that teaching and we put it together, what we can understand is that God does allow divorce for adultery, for abuse, and for neglect. We can string all those together to figure that one out. Now, let me be clear. Divorce should never be the first option. And when you enter a marriage, it should never be in your mind that this could end in divorce. That should never be the first steps that you're taking and the mentality that you view it with. Because see, divorce will have consequences. There is emotional and mental damage that's done for long term. And if there's children and on, there's lots of reasons divorce is very damaging. As freeing as you might think it's going to be, there's going to be baggage with that. If you are married and you think you're in a bad situation, go get some help. Go get some counseling. Talk to your pastors to start with. And if it's very serious, you may need to get some prolonged counseling to work through those things. See, God is able to work in our brokenness and in our broken lives to restore relationships. And while God gave permission for divorce in some cases, he never prescribed divorce. He never said, you must divorce, thou shalt divorce. So while divorce may be an option at times, so is forgiveness, and so is restoration. That should be the first goal. There's a lot for us to take home from all this today. You know, I find it a bit ironic. When I talk to single people, most of them want to be married. And I get that. And my heart goes out to you single people who want to get married. But sometimes I talk to married people, and married people want to be single. Kind of an irony there. You know, the grass is not always greener. Sometimes I wonder if we just are discontent people, and we want what we want, but we want what we think we want, but sometimes we don't really know what we're getting into. So Paul talks about marriage, divorce, singleness, and celibacy here. He expounds all these things. But I would suggest that there is a greater overarching point. There's a greater overarching principle that he's trying to make clear here. In verse 17, he says this, each of you should continue to live in whatever situation the Lord has placed you. Whatever he has given you, wherever you're at right now, continue to live that way. Embrace that moment. In verse 35, then he says this, I am saying this for your benefit, not to place restrictions on you. I want you to do whatever will help you serve the Lord best with as few distractions as possible. So ultimately, he says, thrive in the situation you find yourself in. Wherever you find yourself today, serve the Lord with everything you've got in that capacity. Married people, do not let your marriage be a distraction. Serve the Lord together with your marriage. You know, Paul points out some advantages to being single and the freedom that comes in ministry by being single. And while I understand his point, I think my experience and the experience of many others that I would know says that if a couple chooses to use their marriage to serve the Lord together, then marriage can enhance and empower ministry rather than encumber it. Can I give a quick shout out to my lovely wife, Deanna? I could not imagine doing ministry without her. She enhances my ministry in so many ways. What the things that you see that I do well, a lot of that's because of her. The things that I do bad, it's because I'm probably not listening to her. But our marriage works together in ministry. Use your marriage in that way. For singles, don't view your singleness as a restriction. Look at your singleness and serve the Lord with the freedom that you have. Paul talks all about that through the whole chapter 7. Read that for yourself. Read the whole chapter. He talks about the great freedom that you have as single people. To sum this whole thing up, to give you a takeaway. Here's your takeaway today. Okay? Restriction and distraction both leave us stressed. In freedom and focus, we serve God best. Say that with me. Restriction and distraction both leave us stressed. In freedom and focus, we serve God best. Father, thank you for this day. I thank you for the opportunity to look into your word and to learn about marriage and singleness from your perspective. Lord, I want to ask you to empower us to live in the state that you have put us in, whatever that might be, whether we're married or whether we're single. Help us to serve you with everything we have. Lord, I also want to pray for all the moms today. Thank you for them. And Lord, for those that are hurting today because of different circumstances surrounding Mother's Day, I pray for them that you would comfort them and give them hope, give them peace. In Jesus' name, amen.